Maybe you can tell me how you got started in baseball. I know you're from Marseille.
I was born and raised on a farm outside of Marseille. Mm-hmm. And in those days, you could play baseball anywhere when you were a kid. Every little town had a ball team, because no one had any money and no one had any cars or anything. You just walked and you'd play ball. Well, I was pitching for Marseilles when I was 15 years old. And they had a good ball club. They had a couple of boys on the team by the name of Brundage Brothers. They played in the minor leagues. They could still hit, but they couldn't run or throw like they should. And I got down there, I pitched for them for 3 years, and we played twice a week. We lost one game in 3 years. And I told my dad out on the farm, there's got to be an easier way to make a living. There has to be. Because I was working for $20 a month, 4 a.m. till dark at night. So I told my dad, I seen the paper where they were having a tryout down Rock Island, in the Mississippi Valley right. League. So I go down there and there's 82 ball players, kids. And I'm just a kid. So my dad says, well, you go on down, and if you make it, fine. If you don't, why, I could always come back to the farm, you know. Well, I went down there. Every week there'd be a few missing. 3 weeks. Or 3 weeks, we were down to 5 players, and I was one of them. And Ever Swanson was another one, which the White Sox bought. So Pat Patterson was the manager and also the catcher on the Rock Island Ball Club. And he says, you're pitching tomorrow against Peoria. They were in the 3I League at the time. This is 1928. And I says, fine. He says, I want you to win that game. I said, I want to win every game and go out there. So I won the game 2-1. And that set me up with the club. He told me after the game, he said, you're pitching opening day. You've made the ball club. You're going to pitch opening day. I says, fine. So I won 11 in a row. And then like any cocky kid, you know, I told him, the manager, we're on the bus going to Cedar Rapids. And we traveled to old Rio bus. He was a bus driver. In those days, he was a bus driver, ticket seller, everything else. So I told him, he said, you're pitching opening up now on this road trip. You're pitching. I said, nobody can beat me in this league. I've beat every team. I said, I ain't worried about it. Huh? So he figured, that kid's getting a little cocky, you know. And boy, did I get a shellacking that day. And I accused him of giving the hitters the signals, the signs, because, man, they were stepping into curveballs. I'd beat them before. They weren't nothing else. But boy, did they give me a shellacking. And he never took me out. I finished the whole game. After the game, he says, you wonder why I didn't take you out? You're not so cocky, are you? He says, you can get beat, you know, once in a while. I says, no, I says, I didn't wonder about it, but I said, I sure got a shellac, and I think you gave him the sides, and he didn't say yes or no. I still to this day think he did, but maybe not. Well, anyhow, I got off to a real good start, and won 19 games, and the end of the season, we played Moline. We were rivals, and Moline had a good ball club. They had Bob Weil in the pitcher, and Konecki and two, three other good ball players, Crabtree, and we had two, three good ball players. So we beat Moline 2 out of 3. They played a 3-game. See, in those days, the town owned the ball club. There were no major league clubs involved at all. So we won the series. They had a 3-game series just so the clubs could make some money, because they were rivals, Moline and Rock Island, right across the line, and they packed them in. But, of course, 5,000 is a trippy crowd.
Sure.
And that's what we had. So after the ball game, After we won the last game, Pat Patterson called me into the office. He says, "Kid," he says, "we sold you." I said, "Sold me?" He says, "Yeah, you're joining Cincinnati and Chicago tomorrow morning." I said, "Cincinnati?" I says, "I haven't got any money." He says, "Don't worry about a thing." He says, "We got your bus fare and you join them in the hotel." Told me the name of the hotel, and I don't know what it is now. And Jack Hendricks was the manager of the Reds. He says, "You go up to his office, he'll take care of you from there." So, okay. They had the bus ticket. I had $10 in my pocket. I never had a suit, you know. I just had, like kids go today, sport shirt, sweater, pants. And I got to Chicago all right, got the hotel. I went to the desk, and I always thought afterwards, I get laughing to myself, that that desk manager must have thought that kid is some daddy. He just looks like a tramp, you know, going to the big leagues. So I told him I was here to join the Cincinnati Reds. I'm supposed to meet Jack Hendricks. So he gets on the phone, he calls up, and evidently Jack Hendricks had said, "Send the kid up," because he says, "You go up to room so-and-so, he's waiting for you." I go up to the room, and I introduce myself. I said, "I'm Cy Johnson." He says, "I know who you are, kid." He had a rough voice. He says, "We've been expecting you." He says, "You better get a suit, the hat, some new shoes. And you're in the big leagues, you know." I says, "I haven't got any money." I said, "All I've got is $10. I can't." He said, "Wait a minute." He said, "I'll get on the phone." He got a call. George Kelly, the first baseman. His nickname was High Pockets. I never met him, didn't know nothing about him. He told George Kelly, he said, "Come down here to the room, I want to see you." So George, pretty soon he got, Christ, 6'6", mountain of a guy. I looked at him, I thought, "Oh God, you know, scared to death. Take this kid down town," he says, "get him a suit, shirt, socks, underwear, cap, or a hat, new suitcase. I want him to have everything." He said, "The big leagues, I want him to have everything." And he pulled out a roll of bills on us, and God, like that, gave him to George Kelly. George says, "Okay, kid, come on." Man, I hung on to his arm, I was scared. Boy, I'd never been in Chicago in my life. And boy, I was scared. We got down this one great big store, and I don't know how many suits I tried on. George Kelly, of course, was like a father to me. He was okay and everything. He bought me 6 different colored shirts, neckties, socks, new shoes, great big nice leather suitcase, hat. I've never had a hat on in my life. No hat, cap, you know, a kid's going. So I put the hat on, and I thought, "Oh God, I can't wear these." Kelly says, "Kid, you're the big leagues. You're wearing hats now. You got to wear a hat. You got to be dressed up." Okay. So then after I get all set, come back to Jack Hendricks' room, and quite a bit of money left. So George Kelly says, "Here's money that's left, Jack." He says, Jack says, "Give it to the kid." I after I got off the loan somewhere, there was over $200. Wow. I never had that much money in my life. I thought, geez, $200 already. This is great, boy. Oh, okay, I got out to the clubhouse, and Hendricks, after I get in uniform and everything, Hendricks takes me around, introduces me to all the players. They had a locker with my name on and everything. I thought, boy, this. The trainer, he says, "Young fellow, we've been expecting you." He says, "You got to get 6 sweatshirts." Okay. Oh, a couple of heavy ones, some light ones, and some real light ones. And he says, "You got to get a dozen pair of socks, half a dozen jock straps, and a pair of Spalding featherweight baseball shoes." They were 20. $26 a pair, I think. I thought, I see why I got that $200. Boy, that just went like this, you know. I got all that stuff and got out on the field. I was so excited and so shook up. And I look around, there's 32 or 33,000 people there. And the coach come over. He says, kid, warm up your pitch and bat practice. Okay. And I didn't know pitch and bat practice. I thought, boy, I'm going to give them all I got. Jesus, I just wound up and fired. But that only went about three pitches. Coach says, hey, this is batting practice, not a ball game. You throw them in there and let them hit them. So I told them in there, God, they were going out of the park everywhere. I thought, Jesus, this they ain't gonna, they'll fire me with the way they're hitting. it was something. But then later on, I got into three ball games before the season was over. Games that were lost, you know, yeah, just sure. A kid. I'd get in the seventh inning and maybe wind up the game, and they never scored or I never lost a game in the three times I was out.
Mop-up situation.
Yeah, right. just giving the kid, or in other words, see what the kid's got, mm-hmm. You know, just get him a little bit used to it. And after the season, of course, I came home and my dad greeted me. Boy, he came down to the train in Marseilles to pick me up, and he threw his arms around me. He said, kid, I knew you could make it. But when I went down there, he said, you haven't got a chance. And a lot of my buddies I run around with, they're just like, in those days, it seemed like people were jealous or something if you made a little headway or something. Some would say, oh, the word had come back, he's lucky. He must do somebody, he's lucky, he's all that, you know. But
it's hard to win 11 games in a row on luck, wouldn't you?
Well, it was, I don't know, like a lot of the coaches to play in those days, Major League ball, you had to have guts. You wouldn't get nowhere being timid, I'll tell you that. Because we had brushback pitches, which they don't allow anymore. We had them right with our fastball, curve, change of pace, and so forth. And it was, now baseball is just a different ball game. They wear hitting gloves, sliding gloves, helmets, and now they're throwing 14 different, they have to give signs with both fingers. I don't know how the hell they can do it to all the different pitches they got. It's the same thing, it's just a curve ball, but they got knuckle curves and split fingers, fastballs, right. I never heard of that stuff. Nobody had. It's just some guys made an idea that, boy, that. But
well, the slider was pretty new at that time too, wasn't it? The slider was just coming in about that.
Well, the slider came in about the last year or two after I quit. Really, the slider is on the order of a curve, only don't break as much, and just a little faster. That's what you throw it the same way, only grip a slider a little harder. I couldn't see any different than a slider, because the last few years when I was coaching the pitchers, and they'd ask me, how do you throw a slider? I said, you throw it just like you do your curveball. Hold on to it, grip it a little harder, it won't break as much, you know. And throw it as hard as you can, or it won't break. With a curveball, you don't throw it just as fast as you can throw it unless you got a snappy little short curve, you know. Some have that too, but they're hard to control. And that's one of the main things about pitching is control. Like Warren Spahn, I was with Warren Spahn and Johnny Sain and Johnny Antonelli and those guys when I was coaching with the Braves. Well, you didn't have to tell Spahn or saying anything. They knew how to pitch, right? They were like Roberts, if it was at the Phillies. Their first year up, they knew how to pitch. And same way with Tom Seavers. he's outstanding. Yeah. All those guys, there's some like that, but you don't find many of them.
Yeah.
I can remember Noel Ryan when he came up. I thought the Giants, New York was crazy when they let him go and traded him. You could hardly see the ball. He just threw bullets, but he didn't know where it was going. But look at him today. One of the best. One of the greatest.
Back.
Yes, sir. It's a lot different. And I roomed with Dizzy Dean for a couple of years when I was with the Cardinals.
What, now you were with the Cardinals, what, 36 through
39? Yeah, 36, right? 78, I think, right. 9.
And was 37 when Dean had the accident in the All-Star game? Was that the year?
I believe.
Broke the toe?
It probably was, because I was there, and he got hit in the toe by a line drive by Earl Averill and broke his big toe. And he kept pitching. He said, he should never let him pitch. He should have let it heal. And that's how he hurt his shoulder, too, because he was not following through. He just thrown with his arm.
Well, it was known that his toe was broken, right?
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't hiding anything.
He had a broken toe. Everybody knew that. Yeah, I remember that. I was in 5 All-Star games, but I never got in to pitch. I got down in the bullpen a few times, but I can remember that just like it was now.
Well, when you went back to Marseille after that first season, did you work on your father's farm over the winter? Or
yeah, I stayed at home with my dad and
kept in shape that
way.
I
always kept in shape because I'd done an awful lot of hunting, off whatever I could. I'd do a lot of fishing. Always outside. I was an outside person. I loved the outside. To keep me in the house, that was just like a prison to me, boy. I had to be out.
Well, what happened? I'm sorry.
And when I first came home, Marseille asked me if I would pitch next Sunday an exhibition game for him, maybe help him get out of the red or money for the coming year. I says, listen, I'll do anything for you, because they were good to me. And I pitched a Sunday for him against a good pickup team, and we won the game, no problem, but had a terrific crowd. Must have had nearly 5,000 people, I believe, there. They were charging 50 cents a head. So, of course, in those days,
money.
You know, money in those days was scarce. Man, when I played the first year with Cincinnati for $2,500, the most I ever made in my life was $7,500. That's the most I ever got. Chick Hafey and I both missed spring training. $10,000 was the top salary. Chick was holding out for $10,000. He had a terrific year. And he was our center fielder. He's holding out for $10,000. I won 14 games. I think I lost 19, something like that, 18 or 19. And I'm holding out for $7,500. And when we both missed spring training, never won spring training. And I pitched opening day. I pitched 5 opening days in a row and never won a game. Never won a one. When you pitch opening day, you're always pitching against the best pitcher of the other clubs. Not always have to be pitched against either Lon Warnicker or Charlie Root or someone with the Cubs, and then Pittsburgh might be Bill Brandt, or, you know, one of their better pitchers. But I'd lose 3-2, 4-2, 3-1. So all close games, but that didn't make any difference. You got to win them.
You know, one thing that kind of caught my attention was, what was that? Yeah, in 1933, you won 7 games, and 4 of those were shutouts.
Yeah, I can believe that.
That's about the only way you seem to be able to win a game someday,
right,
I suspect.
Right. I know the players, a lot of times, I'd be pitching. We might get off to a 1-0 lead. I'd come into the dugout. The players, they'd be kidding around and say, Si, there's your lead. You better hold them, because that's all you're going to get. And that is the way it'd wind up, 9 out of 10 times.
Yeah, your earned run average was as good as the league average or better.
Well,
most years.
For the kind of ball club, see, we had outfielders that were all washed up as far as speed, like Eddie Roush. Yeah. He was on his last legs, and Kurt Walker. And then we had Harry Heilman when he was all through in Detroit. So, and they couldn't cover any ground. I mean, if the ball was a long fly ball or high fly ball, well, they could get to it. But it might go over their head or might drop in front of them. Well, hell, that's a base hit, you know, where the ball should have been caught. And that's the same with the infield. We had one terrific good ball player on our infield in the latter years. That was Tony Cuccinello. We roomed together, he and I, for 7 years. We were just like brothers. And
he was a great ball player.
Terrific ball player. Smart, good head on him, good ball player. When I joined the Reds, with George Kelly at first, he's on his last legs, mm-hmm. Huey Kreitz at second base, Horace Ford at shortstop, Bill Sitzman at third base, and Bubbles Hargraves, a catcher, Walker and Eddie Roush and Pid Purdy in the outfield.
Old
had
club.
Good pitching staff, though, had Epper Rixian.
Right.
And Red Lucas, Pete Donahue, and Adolph Lukey, and they were all good pitchers.
Right.
Very good. But they were getting the end of their rope, too, you know.
Now, Red Lucas was quite a pinch hitter, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a good hitter. He was a good hitter. He was our first pinch hitter off the bench, left-hand hitter. Yeah, Red, and he was one of the main pitchers, too.
Did he ever save any ball games for you with a pinch hit?
Well, I can't, God, I'd have to go back. I can't remember, really, because that's years ago.
I thought maybe that might jog your memory on that.
A bit odd. Been out of baseball, you know, 42 years, and you got to think back. A lot of times, that's why I got that baseball encyclopedia. A lot of times, I'll sit here and I'll think, well, look, how the hell many games did he win? I'll get the book out. Uh-huh. I got it right there,
yeah,
you know.
Right there.
Right there.
Well, did the Reds put you with a minor league club for the 29?
Yeah, at Columbus.
Not too far away, then.
No. They owned Columbus at that time. So they didn't want to send me down, but they had five good starting pitchers. And me being a kid, like the coach and manager said, Cy, you'll be better off if you go down, and we don't like to send you down, because I had a good spring training. I was pitching against Yankees and all the other clubs and was doing real well. We hate to, but you won't be down there but a half a year, and we'll have you back here. And they did. They did. And Cuccinello was in Columbus, so we came back together. So we were just regular buddies all the way through.
Was it much the same situation in 1930 then?
1930? You know, yeah. The same order,
Columbus,
yeah.
Columbus again?
Yeah.
What kind of seasons did you have in 29 and 30 with Columbus?
29 and 30? Gosh, I'd have to get the book. Look at the book. I got it right out.
Oh, the minor league record? I'm talking about Columbus.
Columbus. I had a good record there. Okay. I think it was 18 and 5 or 6, something like that. And I was there, probably their main pitcher, because I was pitching every third day and third, fourth day. And that was a good league. Boone was manager. They had Toledo. Casey Stengel was managing Toledo.
Yeah, I guess that would be right.
Yeah, and he was pinch hit once in a while. I know he pinch hit against me, and he had a line drive like a shot right at the second baseman. So Casey was a funny guy, you know, anyhow. And we got to be pretty good friends when he was managing the Braves, and I was with Cincinnati. And the Braves were way down the basement.
Right.
I used to come out to the park if I was going to pitch. I was the last one out of the clubhouse. Casey was hitting to the infield. I walked by him one day. I said, Casey, how's the things going? He says, Cy, they're all professionals. They were down the basement. I got a laugh and I couldn't help it. He says, they're all professionals. He always had an answer.
Of course.
Oh, boy. What a character.
Huh.
He was a dandy.
Well, how did he do with the Mud Hens, with the Toledo team? When you
good. He was. They were a good ball club. Seemed like every team down there was a pretty good ball club. They weren't easy.
Well, you came to the Reds to stay in 1931 then. You became one of the big pitchers on the staff that year.
Yeah.
And 11 games. Can't complain about that.
Well, that wasn't too good in those days, you know. Not like today.
Well, for a team that wins 58.
Yeah, that's... I know. But in those days, when you start the ball game, they expect you to finish
right.
it. Today, they got... I've listened to them on... television. I'll listen to the managers. You go out, you give me 5 good innings and I'll have help for you. And then counting the pitches. They count every pitch you make.
Right.
Never done that when I was playing.
You expected to start with you, or finish you what you started.
Finish the game no matter how many pitches. And now they got the speed gun and if you throw 100 pitches, they take you out no matter what. Whether you're leading or How many complete games do you see today? God, if a pitcher has 3-4 complete games in a year, he's had a hell of a year.
Oh, they wonder what went wrong.
Yeah,
What's
right.
the matter with your bullpen?
Jeez. Yeah, middle relief, and then a close reliever. Oh, boy.
Who was the first reliever, the first person whose job was to be a reliever? Was it Roy Hunt Henshaw, somebody like that, or...? Who started
you mean
that?
For what club or where?
Well, in the National League. Who was the first person that
strictly for relief?
Yeah, his job was to be the relief man.
Oh, God. Who in the heck would that be? It'd have to be somebody that had good control, threw hard like that. I know the last few years there with Cincinnati, I was starting and also in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. And I done quite a bit of relieving. But for a real, real good relief pitcher, you kind of got me there. I don't know who that could be, really.
I just wonder if there's somebody you remembered that was the first person to be tagged as a reliever.
No, I can't think of anyone offhand, really, that was just strictly a relief pitcher.
What was your best pitch?
My fastball. Fastball and curve and... It took maybe 4 or 5 years before I got control. I always tried to wind up and throw everything by him, you know.
A lot of motion on your fastball,
yeah,
I guess?
Yeah, and I had a good fastball.
Did it rise?
I know when I first came up to Cincinnati, some of the old catchers there, like Bubbles Hargraves, and then they had Clyde Soupforth and some of those fellows in there. And some of them said I threw nearly as hard as Walter Johnson. Mm. And the first guy I hit against or pitched against in the big leagues was Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Really?
Yeah, he was with St. Louis.
And on the way out about that time.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Sure. He was practically done. I got a base hit off of him first time up into right field. And next day the paper says, Johnson's not going to be just a great pitcher. He's going to be a great hitter, too. I never hit my weight in my life. I thought, boy, I got them fooled.
Didn't Alexander start his minor league career in roughly this area, in someplace in Illinois? Did he play on the minor league team first?
Can I show you a minute?
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
I've got playing for, which, like peanuts, he played probably cheaper than I did. That's a good story.
I'll be very interested.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy that
I'm
very
sure
much.
I will.
You'll probably be one in 1,000 that's got that clipping.
I imagine so.
Yes, sir.
You got to hit off old Pete.
Yeah, right. I got to hit off Pete right field.
You were a right-handed hitter.
Right-handed swinger, I should say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Hitting wasn't your strong point.
No, hitting was... really a weak point, but I had them fooled for the first year. but they soon found my weakness. They started throwing the curveball.
A lot of people have that weakness.
Yeah, usually the pitchers will have a union. You know, don't throw me a curveball, I won't throw you any. A lot of them are an artist, you know, like Carl Hubble and I were pretty good buddies. And I told Carl, you can get me out with just a fastball. You don't have to throw that damn screwball to me. And he finally threw me one day. And I swung twice at it. It still wasn't up to the plate. And I wound up, I hit my toe with the bat. It jumped and goes right straight. I looked at him and he turned his back and his shoulders were just laughing his head off. And I told him after the game, I said, "You fathead, I will never trust you again. Never."
Was it a crucial situation?
No, heck no. He just wanted to have some fun. That's all he was doing. He laughed his head off. But, oh, what a screwball that guy had. Oh, man. And that's the first one I'd ever looked at. Because, hell, when I'm up there hitting, they didn't monkey around. Just throw three fastballs and let them go sit down.
Well, there weren't many screwball pitchers around.
Not good ones. No.
Who was maybe the next one? Spahn?
Spahn, he had a fair.
Oh.
But there was no one compared to Hubble. And that's why when you'd see Hubble walk, his arm, the arm way out, you know, he'd thrown so many that is. But what a terrific pitcher he was.
Was he the best pitcher you saw in your years in the National League?
When he and Diaz had hooked up, it was just a question. You know, neither team is going to get many runs. It had to be 1-0 or 2-1. My God, you wouldn't know who you'd pick because I've seen Diaz one day, and I roomed with him, and he'd been out about all night. And he'd come in, and I said, "Dish, you're working," crying out loud, "you're pitching." He said, "Don't worry about old Diaz, you know." And he went out, and I think he struck out 15, and he won the game 1-0. He was something else. But there's only few like that could do that, you know.
Of course.
Absolutely. Poor old Cy, I'd pitch it tomorrow, boy. I'm in bed 9 o'clock. I gotta try to get him out.
Well, Dizzy's brother Paul was a pretty good pitcher,
too. Yeah, yeah. But he was not the showboat that Diz was.
He was by far.
And he didn't have the stuff Diz had. He could throw hard, but Diz had, along with his great curveball, change of pace, and fastball, he had perfect control along with it. And he'd showboat. He could have had terrific earned run average. But if he'd get a 5-6-7 run lead, he'd go into the hitter and tell him what he's going to throw. He would. And he'd strike him out. Yeah, he was something else. He just...
Some wonderfully colorful people like Dean, Stengel, and so forth.
Yeah. Pepper Martin. They were all terrific hustlers and showboats. Not really. You couldn't really say showboats either because they back up everything they do.
Right.
So they were just good. They could do it and get by with it, see.
I'm reminded of something I read once. Branch Rickey said that if he had to deal with one more person like Dizzy Dean, he would get out of the game.
Well, I think he would too.
What kind of dealings did you have with Rickey?
Oh, that guy was nuts. I had trouble with him when I was holding out for $7,500. I didn't sign to him. He calls me up. I lived here. He called me up and he says, "I'd like to have a meeting with you so we can get this contract settled before spring training." I said, "Well, you know what I want. I've already sent you a letter. And if you're not going to pay that, there's no need having a meeting." I says, "Come down and we'll talk about it." Well, I said, "You're going to pay my expenses?" He says, "We'll talk. Just come down here." So, okay. I told the wife, and she went with me, and we went down there. And I went up to his office, and he pulls a sleeping act on you. You know, that's his trick. The players had told me that before.
I'm not sure what the sleeping act is.
Well, you go in his office, see? You say, "Hi, bud." "Hi." And he sits back in his big chair with his feet cocked up, you know. He just sat there like this. Won't say nothing. Well, I looked at my watch about 10 minutes. I get up and I'm going to the door. Finally I get the door. He says, "Hey, wait a minute, where are you going?" I says, "I didn't come down here to see you sleep." I said, I could sleep anywhere, watch you sleep anywhere. I didn't come down for that. I came down to either sign for $7,500 or forget it. Trade me, sell me, release me. No, can't trade you. I don't want to release you. And $7,500 is too much. Oh, I said, then just forget it. I said, well, what do you want from me? I'll buy my own contract. I'll buy myself from you. I'll buy the contract. Oh, no, we've never done nothing like that. So I said, well, Mr. Rickey, I'm sorry. And I went out the door and went back home. And finally, he called me, oh, 4 or 5 days, I guess, or so afterwards. He says, well, come on down. I'll send you the contract. You can sign it to see your spring training. So I got my $7,500. But he was tough cookie to do business with.
Well, not everybody got from him what they wanted.
Well, not everyone. No way. No way, because I talked to, like, Fibber McGee was one. And who the heck was the other pitcher? Another kind of a young pitcher. And they says, how did you get along with Rickey? And I told him exactly what I'd done. And then, of course, I'd been around a while, a few years then. And
8 or 9 years.
Yeah, something like that. And if I'm going to make any money out of it, I want to make it now. You know, I'm going to a pretty good ball club, the Cardinals.
Yeah.
I wanna make it now, and I never bellyached about anything out there pitching. I worked hard every time I went out there. I gave all I had, all the time, whether it's relief or whether it's starting. And that's what I told the kids, the other guys. And they said, well, we're only getting $2,000. I can't hardly live on it. You know, guys were staying at hotels, and that's what he'd do. Finally, Johnny Mize got fed up with him. He wouldn't pay him. So he traded him to, I think it was the Yankees, or traded him to New York or somewhere.
Right, with the Giants.
Yeah, they traded him. Because Johnny Mize told me, he says, oh, I'm not going to stay here and play for peanuts, whether it's Brad Tricky or who it is. And so he got traded, and then he got in big money, you know, which was $35,000 to $40,000. Mize and I were like that. He used to come here and hunt with me all the time, he and his wife. And then when I'd go, my wife and I'd go spring training, we'd stop down in DeLand, Florida.
Oh.
He lived in DeLand, Florida.
Okay.
And then I'd stay down there, and Johnny Mize and I'd fish. And he'd come up here in the fall and hunt with me. He'd come up here and stay a month, and I'd go down there.
You talk about things.
Well, we were buddies, you know. He was with Giants, and I was still with the Cardinals. And
he's moved back to Northeast Georgia now.
Yeah, I know he is.
Stay in touch with him?
Yeah, he's in Georgia, but he had a heart transplant or something. And his wife and my wife are just like sisters. Well, then she died, she smoked a cigarette in bed and caught a fire, and she burned. And John was on a banquet that night, and he came home and he found her. Well, she lived a couple of days afterwards, but he found her in bed there with smoke, you know, and stuff. Bed was about ruined.
Terrible story.
Yeah, and first thing Johnny done, he got on the phone after he got hurt to the hospital. He got on the phone and called my wife. Well, then my wife got all shook up, so she couldn't talk on the phone. She started to crying, carrying on. So then I talked to John, and he explained the whole thing, what had happened. Gene Mize. So that took care of that, and John got married again. I think he married some women with a couple of kids. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but I believe.
I've spoken with him on the phone, but I've never met him.
Yeah? Well, you talked about him,
folks. Yeah.
Yeah. Great guy, real nice guy.
It was a good team that the Cardinals had in the 30s.
You know, they had a good team.
They weren't winning pennants yet, but you could tell that the...
We should have won it that one year in September. We had a five-game lead, and we got beat. Giants came in, swept a three-game series, and then the Cubs came in, swept a three-game series. Diz and I were doing all the pitching.
Would that have been 37?
36 or 37, I think it was.
Yeah.
We finished third, I think.
Fourth, it says here. But you did do a lot of pitching. You got 192 innings in.
I know,
games.
I was pitching quite a bit.
Sure.
Diz and I were pitching way out of turn all the time. There was a Winfred got hurt and Paul Dean and broken arm or something. He was out. Diz would pitch one day and I'd pitch the next, so we just went back and forth like that. Got to be too much, and the Giants had a good ball club, and the Cubs had a good ball club. And I don't know who finished third. Did you have it there?
No, I don't. Find out real quick. Who was your favorite catcher on that team?
On the Cardinals?
Yeah.
Well, they only had Ogrodowski, their one good catcher. He died from what the heck kind of disease did he have?
Well, there was another name I saw there, Spud Davis. I don't know that name.
Oh, yeah, Spud Davis. Yeah, I forgot about him.
I don't know anything about him. Can you clue me in on that?
He was a pretty good-sized man, and he was a good receiver, not just fair hitter, but slow, real slow. He was a big fellow. And then they had another catcher, Wilson.
Find out.
Wilson?
Let's find out here. Don't have the name here. The only catcher they mentioned on the 36 team is Spud Davis. The only one that they... And Ogrodowski.
Ogrodowski. That's the one that I pitched to all the time.
Okay. Spud Davis got in a few more games
than
Ogrodowski. Now, I either wrote it down or my source was wrong. You folks were third. In 36.
Yeah, I thought we finished third.
And 37, let's see where did they end up. 37, fourth. Yeah. That was the year that you won 12. And
I won
Dizzy
12
won
after the middle of the year.
Warnke won 18. And Weiland, I don't know that name.
Bob Weiland, left-hand pitcher.
He won 15.
He was down in the Mississippi Valley League when I was. He came up the same year I did. He was with Moline. Left-hand pitcher, Bob Weiland. And another guy pitched for Cleveland for years. He was in that league the same year. Wore glasses. He was the main pitcher for Cleveland for, cripes sake, 18, 20 years.
Hmm.
Harding? No.
Oh, Mel Harder.
Mel Harder.
There we are.
Yeah,
right.
Mel Harder.
Sure.
He was down there. Yeah. So that league, the Mississippi Valley League, was a tough little league.
Well, some good pitchers, certainly.
Oh, you bet.
Tough on
that
the hitters.
A tough little league, boy.
Tough on the hitters. Let's see, you mentioned Sook Forth was catching.
Yeah, at Cincinnati.
And
but he got his eye shot out. That proved terrific ball player, terrific catcher. Good hitter, young, fast, could do everything. And he got he and somebody of his on the club, he never would tell who it was.
Was it a hunting accident?
Yeah, they were hunting. He got shot, and it was on his right eye, and he was a left-hand hitter. And that ruined him right there.
Then early Lombardi was there the last 3 years you were at the Reds.
Oh, Lombardi was my main catcher. He was there. I remember when they got him from Brooklyn. He and I were teammates for a good many years, for quite a few years.
I got to ask you, how slow was he?
Oh, my God, he was slow. There was no infield when he was hitting. If he could have run, He's a terrific hitter, you know.
Well, they didn't want to get too close to his line drive either.
Well, crying out loud, he could bunt. He tried bunting several times, so the pitcher had a half hour to go over there and get him and throw him out. But boy, he'd still hit over 300 with no infield.
I guess nobody hit any harder than he did.
Oh, he was terrific.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous picture of holding seven baseballs.
What a hand he had.
Oh, it must have been.
I used to wrestle with him in the clubhouse before a game. You know, he's like a bull. God, he'd pinch my head off if he wanted to. He'd get me down, he'd put that big hand in my face and just rub it. Oh, we had a lot of fun together. He'd come out here and stayed with me a couple of weeks after the season. He run his whole family. See, his dad and mother were gone. He was the boss for his sisters and his brothers, all the kids. And I can remember when his one sister got married, she had to call Ernie and see if he'd okay it.
He's from California, is that right?
Ernie Lombardi? Yeah.
Yeah. So he's what? He probably stopped here on his way back home to California.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd come home with me. Heck of a nice guy.
Well, one of the things that happened about the time you came up to the majors certainly was the depression started.
Yeah.
And that affected the salaries, obviously, for the players. And what other ways could you tell it was affecting the Reds? Was it Sidney
Weill?
Well,
when that depression... right next to mine at Cincinnati at the clubhouse. And I came out to park. He was sitting in front of his locker and he was crying. He had his hands in his face. I thought, what in the world? Somebody must have died in the family. You know, I didn't know what happened. I said, Jack, what's your problem? Can I help you? What's wrong? He says, Si, I went to bed. Said I had $80,000. Yeah, I remember that so well. But it got everybody. I mean, but when it takes your last nickel and your last year to make any money, he was quick going to quit because he, my God, he was an old man.
Right, he had pitched.
Oh God,
he'd been in almost 20 years.
Oh, at least 20 years. Had to be 20 years. I have never looked at the book, but he was and a real swell fellow along with it, you know. And I felt so bad for him because...
Well, eventually the whole team went into, the bank took it over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they all went broke and then I think Crossley bought the team.
Well, the story I heard was that the bank that had taken over the team brought in Larry McPhail, who then talked Crossley into...
Oh, Larry McPhail, I didn't know who, but I remember I remember when Larry McPhail joined the club.
Did he make a difference? What kind of a character was he?
I never did like him. He was, I don't know. He just didn't get along with the players. And Lombardi and I roomed together and he came up He'd been drinking quite a bit. He came up to the room and Lombardi got out of bed and threw him out the door. Said, get out. Don't bother me. I'm playing tomorrow. But I guess if you could get along with him, it's all right, but I never could get along with him. Just couldn't get along with him.
Well, certainly, I think most people probably remember him now for introducing night baseball. What other sort of innovative ideas did he have?
He was... I really can't explain it too much, but he was... one thing he did, he put the detectives on all the players that he thought were running around. Well, that didn't set with the players.
Right.
I have a good one. I have a good one told me, he said, some guy was following him, wherever he went was following him, and he says, I turned around and took off after him, and he took off running. I said, if I could caught him, I'd have tore him apart. So then he went up to McPhail, and he told him, he said, don't put the detectives on me, because he says, I'll kill him, I'll get him. And so that took care of him. Well, then he had a detective on me for... where I checked my car, put my car in the garage where I was staying at the hotel, put my car in the garage, and the guy at the garage told me, Cy, who, there's some guy comes in here every night wants to know if your car is in. Oh, I said, is that right? Oh, I'm a detective. So then I fooled him. I always called a cab and left my car in there, so I didn't get bothered anymore. But he did a lot of them silly things like that, and the players didn't go for it. I guess he thought it was all right. I don't know.
Well, it didn't improve the team's record.
No.
A lot, did it?
No, nobody cared for him. I mean, none of the players. No.
What was it like playing on a team that kept coming in at the... in last place? Did it get to be sort of a depressing situation?
The middle of the year, it got like, geez, I've got to go out there, put in another day, and you know you're going to lose. You can just well bet you're going to lose unless something terrific happens when you only win 40-some games and you're in last place, going nowhere. And it got so, it was just a job to go out there,
made
really.
For a long season, didn't it?
Yeah. When I got traded to the Cardinals, I was the happiest guy in the world. Boy, I couldn't wait to get out to the park, because there it was just a different climate, everything. Everybody wanted to win. There wasn't no laughing, kidding in the clubhouse like it did in Cincinnati. You might have thought we'd win a game. They'd sing in the shower and everything after getting the hell beat out of them. I couldn't see that.
Right.
And with Frankie Frisch with the Cardinals, you lost a tough ball game. You sat around and thought about it. You didn't come right in and take a shower. Frisch would say, all right, man, let's think this over a little bit. Think what you done wrong. Think if you gave 100%. If you didn't, you're in trouble. You ought to be ashamed. You know, and he'd chew you out. He'd cuss you out.
Was he the best manager you played for?
No, I would say one of them, uh-huh. But not the best. The best guy that I thought the world of, and a wonderful guy, was Bucky Harris. Bucky was a fella that would he'd never raise his voice to you. He'd never show you up. If he had some trouble to talk over with you, he'd call you in the office. And talk to you like a father about everything, but after you've played so many years, he didn't expect you to make too many mistakes. Now, he would tell, like, young guys, he would allow them one mistake, but don't make the same mistake twice, because then he'd take your money. But he wouldn't never show you up. He used to get me as a manager, come out when you're on a pitching mound, you're doing the very best you can, and then come out and chew your butt off in front of everybody else, you know. And you feel like telling them, get the hell out of here. I'm doing all I can do, you know. And but Fritz. I like to play for Fritz. He'd chew you out if you had it coming. And that's good enough for me, you know.
Sure.
But Bucky was just, he just had a system of his own.
And a successful system.
And anybody that didn't like to play for him, boy, you better have a meeting with yourself, because you've got to be wrong.
You didn't get to play for him too much, did you?
Though? No.
Only there for part
I went
of the
into the service.
Season, right?
I was having my best year, too. I was 8-2, and I went into the service July, first part of July, I believe. I can't just tell you the date, but I would have had a good year that year. I'm sure I would, because everything was going fine, and I was pitching good ball. Wasn't getting too many runs, but I was pitching good ball.
Mm-hmm. The Navy you went into?
Yeah.
That's what I thought I heard.
Yeah, so I was there for 3 years, and that that didn't do any good either.
Yeah, oh yeah, 3.7 earned run average. Yeah, you were pitching real well.
Yeah, I was doing, looked like a good year. So,
let's see, who was on that the Phillies team? Well, let's see, a fellow I met just last month, Walter Milley.
He lives in Chicago.
That's right. Yeah, he's still doing some scouting for the Astros.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
I didn't know whether he was in baseball or not.
Still getting around.
We were in the service together.
Was the Phillies team similar to the Reds team in that there were a lot of players at the end of their careers?
Yeah. Chuck Klein was coach, and I roomed with him when I was with the Phillies. And but Benny Warren was a good catcher. If he'd have been with a good ball club, he was a good catcher. Livingston was a good catcher. But then just didn't have any power. No, it seemed like we couldn't get any runs.
Yeah, I remember, I'm trying to recall what it was I read about that, but I was looking to see how many home runs the team hit that year.
Oh, it's
almost
nothing.
None.
No.
A little bit better luck on the road than at home.
Yeah, there's no
with the home runs. But.
Jerry Nugent owned a club. Well, anyhow, he was one of the nicest owners that I have ever played for, too. And after I was out of baseball, everything else, Mr. Nugent would always send me a Christmas card, and was happy I was with the Phillies, and if I ever come to Philly, to look him up. He was just a wonderful guy. No money, just went broke.
Well, the Phillies lost one owner, didn't they? William Cox.
Yeah.
I guess he was kicked out of the game permanently for betting on the, or on or against the Phillies, which was...
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but he got kicked out. And he was one that got me in a little bit of a jam with the commissioner, but not too bad. But they picked me on the, I was 8-2 record. And the manager picked me for the All-Star game to pitch batting practice. And he had 2-3 of his teams, there's Billy Southworth. He had 2-3 teams on our guys on his team that didn't have near the record. So Cox got teed off about the whole thing. And he says, he called me up the office. He said, "Si, don't you go to that All-Star game. Don't you do it." He says, "Well, they've got, when they're that lousy, you got a better record than putting your all of them that's on the pitching staff. And they take you to pitch batting practice. Forget it. I'll protect you." Okay, I thought, all right. That's the way you want it. It's the boss.
Right.
So I didn't go. Well, then it came out in the paper. Well, then the commissioner called me. He said, "Why didn't you go to the All-Star game?" I said, "Because Mr. Cox said not to go because they had picked me for batting practice pitcher, and my record was much better than what Southworth had on the team." He says, "I don't want you to go over there to pitch batting practice. You should be a starting pitcher." one of the pitchers. So well, then the commissioner, he said, well, I'm sorry that you didn't make the team, it didn't come to the team and come to the All-Star game. But he says, I'll look into it with Mr. Cox. Well, then there was quite a write-up in the paper. Well, then when I pitched the Cardinals came in, the Phillies, and I pitched, and the fans, they had quite a crowd there. And the fans got on Southworth, something terrible. Man, they're just riding the daylights out of them. And then they were giving me a big ovation every time I came to the plate, and I won the game. I beat them the game. And after the game, Billy Southworth says, Cy, he says, I'm so sorry I didn't pick you to pitch on the team. He says, I didn't realize what your record was. I said, I forgot all about it, Billy. Just leave it as that. I don't want to be involved anymore. Forget it. So that was all taken over.
Interesting story.
That's what happened. And I don't know about Cox, if he done the betting or anything. I don't know about that. I can't tell you.
That's what the story is.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm not gonna be involved.
We'll comment
in something
on that.
I don't know about. Well, I can't tell you.
Did you do any ball playing when you were in the service, or were you?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah. We had the greatest team in baseball at the Great Lakes. I would have loved to pitch on a team like that in the big leagues. Huh. We had around 40, 45 players.
Who was on the team?
Well, we had two first basemen. Johnny Mize was one. Joe McCarthy, who played with the Giants, was the other one. Second base, we had Billy Herman and another guy from the American League. Shortstop, we had Al Glossop and Hartfield. Third base, we had Merle May and another American League player. I can't think of his name. We had Fireball Trucks and myself and Schoolboy Rowe and Bill Brandt, the four pitchers on the club.
Good
then
staff.
We had McCullough and West, another guy catch. We had three catchers. Then we had Walter Millies too, but he didn't do much catching. And we had terrific outfield. I don't know who the heck they all were. Now we had so many. But when Mickey Cochran was the manager, he was the officer and the manager. And when he'd go to Detroit every once in a while, he'd take a 2 week vacation. Then I'd run the club because I was the oldest one on the ball club. So there was nothing to run the ball club.
Oh, that's a great team.
Well, I'd pick out a couple of old coaches, put them on the base, and I'd tell the players, play as many innings as you want, whatever, whenever you want off, just tell me, and I'll put another guy in, because I had them sitting all over the place. So that worked out just fine. Heck, we didn't lose. I think we went a couple of years, a year and a half or so, without losing a game.
Did you play other service teams? Or?
Oh, yeah. But Fireball Trucks, he was right in the prime of life. He was a terrific pitcher.
Great pitcher.
Yes, he was terrific. We'd play a tough team where he'd pitch. You know, we played all the major league teams. We'd beat them all. Fireball, he'd pitch against most of the big league teams.
Well, how did you land with the Braves after the war? Were you traded to them?
I was traded to them from the Phillies. So Billy Southworth was managing, and Billy and I were pretty good friends. And the Phillies wanted to release me, which is fine. I wanted to get away from them anyhow, because I couldn't see nothing there exciting to me. So Billy Southworth called me and wanted to know if I'd like to join Braves. I said, sure. He says, well, get ready, come over anytime you came over to Boston. I went over there and I pitched about a year and a half for him, then I coached.
And you pitched well for them,
yeah,
too.
I did. I coached 47, 48, 49, and 50. I quit. The wife said, she says, Si, I've had so much of this. She says, I'm living in suitcases. I'm tired of it. We've owned our home and never lived in it because we lived in Florida for 3 years. And
in the land area?
Oh, we live in Sarasota. Paul Derringer and his wife, and my wife and I, and Bill Sissel and his wife, and Paul Wehner and his wife, and Paul got a divorce. And Bill Rigney and his wife, and we had a crew down there. And we played golf all winter.
It's a beautiful area.
Yeah, Sarasota was beautiful. And it didn't cost a fortune, you know. Mm-hmm. You could go out, you carry your own clubs, and you could play 18 holes, you know, for a couple of bucks. Where once a while you'd have a little trouble at the 19th hole in the clubhouse. You'd have to go in there. Wehner, Derringer, a bunch of the guys, and then you'd have a few beers, you know, and talk things over and line up for the next day.
Right, got to plan the next day.
Yeah.
<sure.
laughs> Play for a dime a hole, you know, like today. I was just reading before you came the Chicago paper about Jordan.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. I bet them, what? $10,000, $12,000 on a hole? Golf? Just so.
Well, he's a good golfer, but still.
Oh, I know, but jeebers, jeebers. Of course, like I was thinking, as long as he's not betting on basketball, it's his own money, and he's got millions of it, millions of dollars. He wants to go bet on golf. I can't see. Well, they can stop him if he wants to bet $100,000 on a hole. It's his money. Let him bet it. They got gambling all over the country anymore anyhow.
Was there any gambling going on? We kind of talked about Mr. Coxwell, but was gambling something that was going on in the 30s? When I was playing?
Yeah, not that I know of. No. But it was so much different, you know. Now, when I played Judd Landis, commissioner, and a tough cookie. Every spring, every player in every league and every player got a personal letter from Landis, signed by Landis. We weren't allowed even to go to a racetrack, let alone betting. We weren't allowed in the racetrack. We weren't allowed to talk to people in the ballpark when you were in uniform, like out on the field. Someone call you over the stands, the umpires were stationed up in the stands, and it was an automatic fine if they turned you in. And I know it was tough on me in Chicago because my folks had always come up, but I told them ahead of time, I said, now don't call me over the stands because I can't come over. I won't talk to you. After the game or before the game, fine. But when I'm out on the field, don't call me over. Don't think I'm high hat or nasty about it, but that's the rules. So it worked out all right, but a lot of them kind of figured, geez, he's kind of high hat. He won't even look at me. What the hell? I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, Pete Rose, I've been asked 1,000 times. I don't feel sorry for Pete Rose. I really don't. He's a Hall of Famer. We all know that. He should be there. No question. But he got the same letters that we all did. They're pinned up. If you don't get a letter on top of the letter, it's pinned up on the bulletin board in the clubhouse. The rules.
He knew what the rules were.
Oh, certainly.
And chose
that's
not
why
to.
I don't feel sorry for him. If he bet on baseball, there should be no way that he'd get the Hall of Fame. No way. He should be barred. I don't care. You can talk to old-time ball players. They'll tell you the same thing.
Now, I know this was a little bit before your time in the majors, but then do you have any thoughts about the Black Sox
No.
And any contact with them or people who played with them?
I don't know one of them. I've read about them. But I don't know one thing. Not one thing. I've even talked to Eddie Roush about it. Now, Eddie died a couple years ago. I think he was 90-something. But he was our center fielder. And I used to ask him about some of these old timers. And see, when I came up, when I joined Cincinnati, now, Honus Wagner, he was the coach with Pittsburgh. So Ty Cobb, he would quit altogether. I never did see him. So I don't know nothing about him. But when Harry Heilman joined, the Reds, he used to tell me about Cobb. And they would talk, they'd always talk about Honus Wagner, Scoop, they called him. You've never seen hands on a human being like him. Oh, I shook hands with him. Couldn't see my hand. Boy, if I knew what I know today, knew then, I'd have bought a couple dozen baseballs and had him sign them. Gee, you don't know.
I visited Willard Nixon. You know that name? He pitched for the Red Sox in the 50s. And they used to have old-timers days at Fenway Park. And he did what you were suggesting. He's got old-timer baseball signed from all of those games. Amazing collection.
Well, they're worth some money.
I can begin to imagine what they're worth.
Oh, they're worth some dough. I got five All-Star watches and the World Series watch also, or baseballs all signed. I gave them all to my cousin. He's got them in, he's baseball bug, and he's all been for me, you know, but he's just a kid. He never got to see me pitch, and but he's my favorite cousin, and he comes down here a couple times a week, and he's got my scrapbooks, he's got my baseballs, he's got my All-Star watches, and there's not enough money in the world to get them from him.
Right.
He's got the balls and glass cases, mm-hmm. you know, and
what was it like being with a championship team after all those years? I'm talking about the 48 Braves.
Oh, the World Series?
Yeah.
That was wonderful. It was just, well, just like in a different world. Of course, I was a coach. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be any, couldn't get too active. I could talk, you know, I'd sit with John Cooney and Billy Southwark. And if you see any mistakes or anything going wrong, why, you'd kind of whisper to one another, you know. Coaches work together, naturally.
Sure.
And I was in the service with Kenny Keltner, and when we played Cleveland, and nobody seemed to know anything about Kenny Keltner, and I said, hell, I know Kenny Keltner like a book. I said, I was in the service with him. And he's a strictly a high ball hitter. You got to remember that. And don't try to throw a high fastball by him because there's no way you're going to do it. So he came up to bat with a couple on, and Spahn was out there. And Billy says, go out and talk to him. So I run out there. And I told Spahn, I says, he's strictly a high ball hitter and a fastball hitter. If you keep your curveball down or slow up on him, keep the ball down, you'll get him out. Well, the first pitch Spahn made was, he threw a high fastball, he got it up inside. He entered a country mile, but it was foul. Jesus. Next one he threw down low and hit in double play. He came in, I said, Spahn, I said, I told you the high ball hit. I just got away. I just wound up and was going to throw it as hard as I could. I wanted to get it down, but I got it up. Through the rest of the series, they had no problem with him.
So, that was a great pitching staff.
Oh, yeah. With Spahn and Sane.
Sure.
But the old slogan all over the park or all the papers was Spahn and Sane and play for rain.
Yeah.
That was Because you were done after that.
Kind of forgot, what was it?
Aunt Nellie?
Vern Bigford.
Bigford? Yeah, yeah, Vern Bigford.
11 and 5, that's not a bad record.
Not bad, but he just, he didn't have the stuff the other guys had. You know, it's just the way it panned out. The Braves didn't have good pitching, but we lost the last game on a Billy Sisty button, and was thrown out, but he's a terrific bunter and good ball player and all, but he just bunted it to the pitcher instead of getting it. And then we got a base hit, but we would have won the deciding game, you know.
Awful close.
Yeah.
We talked about the best pitchers that you saw. Can we go around the rest of the team? Who was the best first baseman from those days?
Oh, and in my time, the best first baseman, you could say Jim Bottomley was one of them, for sure. Bill Terry was another one. Outstanding. There was good many good ones.
There were a lot of great first basemen in the 30s, in both leagues, weren't there?
Oh, yeah. Loads of them. And the same, I've been asked that a thousand times to pick out my best team. Oh, my God. I have to pick out two teams because they're so damn good. You can't leave. And like they talk about Brooks Robinson, the third baseman. Brooks Robinson is a terrific ball player and a good friend of mine. But I'll take Pye Trainer. Pittsburgh, greatest I've ever seen. And he was a 330, 340 hitter with power. And you couldn't hit one by him. I don't care how what happened. He was terrific. The best I've ever seen. And that Pittsburgh ball club, they'd get beat. They didn't have any pitching. They'd get beat 11 to 10, 14 to 10. Well, they'd get a lot of runs. Nobody could hold them. They had the two Wainers. Lloyd Wainer's the greatest leadoff hitter I've ever seen. And then Paul Wainer's the next hitter. And he could hit wherever you pitch the ball. That's where he hits them, line drives. Then you get up to their power, Gus Sewer and Wright at second base, and the outfield, they had Woody Jensen and a couple of others I can't recall. Archie Vaughn at shortstop, great ball player. They had a terrific ball club, terrific hitter. So that was, but you take, at second base, you'd have to take, I would have to take, now maybe somebody else, but I'd take Hornsby and Billy Herman.